You are listening to WRIR LP 97.3 FM, and this is Open Source RVA. On today's tuneful and delicious edition of Richmond's Audio News Digest, we talk with Ray Crawley and Carol Ellis, Jr. of Ebony Diamonds. The Richmond Soul Group's 1975 song, I'm So Lucky, has been reissued on 45 on the new Coliseum Records label, and the members tell us all about this unique musical time capsule. Craig Belcher of Coliseum Records also joins us. We'll also talk about the 7th Annual Vegan Restaurant Challenge, which starts January 23rd in restaurants across the city. Chrissy Vandenberg of Vegan Action tells us all about the yummy menu items being featured during the annual event. All of that, plus correspondent Gold Gatsby talks with Virginia delegate Holly Siebel about a new bill introduced in the Virginia General Assembly to limit the use of attack dogs by law enforcement. It's The Source, of course, Open Source RVA.
In the 1970s at Virginia State University, Rodney Dorsey, Carol Ellis Jr., and Ray Crawley first came together as a musical force, initially performing gospel in a dorm room quartet with other friends. Later, under the name Essence, the trio performed at talent shows and in small clubs, but in 1975, as Ebony Diamond, they recorded the song I'm So Lucky with producer Bernard Smith at Richmond's Alpha Audio Studios. Unreleased at the time, this smoother-than-smooth soul tune was rediscovered and issued as a 45 in the UK in 2014, and now, thanks to a new Richmond-focused record label started by local writer and editor Craig Belcher, it has finally received a proper U.S. release. And we're pleased today to welcome two of the members of Ebony Diamonds, and yes, the band name has been both plural and singular, to talk with us about this time capsule RVA gem. Ray Crawley now lives in North Carolina, and Carol Ellis Jr. in Northside. And they are joined by our good friend Craig Belcher, who first met Ray and Carol here at WRIR 10 years ago, when he interviewed them for the Mellow Madness program. Welcome to Open Source RVA, guys.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to be here.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Well, the WRIR was sort of the place where this began, where you first had this idea that you'd want to reissue this song.
Well, that's when I first met the guys, and I got to know them and their music and their story, and that's where our friendship started. And later on down the road, when this opportunity came up, this was I knew this would be a good place to start a new venture.
Right. Right. Well, guys, is it weird for this to be happening, that a song that you guys recorded, 40, 50 years ago is now back?
Well, it's more or less a thing where music sort of takes on its own life, with or without you.
Yeah.
So, we're glad that it's still doing something and it's still out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it picks up a new audience. It's like snowball effect. Somebody that didn't hear it 30 years ago will hear it today or tomorrow whenever they pick up the record from Coliseum Records.
Right. Good point. Talk a little bit about the England. Did they come around to this? Where did people find out about this song?
Yeah, Russell Payne, and he's the and I don't recall the name of his
Super Disco Edits.
That's right. And he was familiar with one of the other songs we did under the name Infinity.
Okay.
Called Queen of My Universe.
Mm-hmm.
So he had heard of that, and then reached out to us to see if we had any more songs that hadn't been released, and that's how it started. And I sent him a sample of it. And he liked it, and he said he wanted to go ahead and release it as a limited release single. And that's what he did. And you know, it was exciting at the time. There were a couple of stores here in Richmond that had them in the shop.
Yeah, where was the gathering place? I love thinking about the record stores of the past.
Yeah,
the Steady Sounds.
Steady Sounds, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was the one, and unfortunately, it's no longer with us. But that was really sad to see. But so we had there, but everything else was in UK, Denmark, Germany. It did pretty well in Europe, but no one really heard it here.
Yeah.
And so few were pressed, it instantly became a collector's item. You know, it sold initially for about $15 and now goes to like $50, $60, the original.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, the other songs that you were doing, you also recorded another song with Bernard Smith where you were kind of backing him, didn't you?
Yes. It was a song called, we were really young.
Yeah. That was the first thing?
That was the first thing. Yeah. That's the first thing we did.
So what, 73, 74?
No, it was 76 maybe, Ray?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, we were still in school.
Yeah.
And it was called For As Long As I Live. Mm-hmm. And
we did backup vocals.
We did backup vocals, and he did list us on a label. And nothing really much happened with that, you know. Mm-hmm. And the B side had our background vocals only, didn't have the lead on it.
Right.
And you know, from that era, you know, the backup vocals were elaborate, you know, harmonies and everything.
So where did you guys play? Was it talent shows? Was it clubs?
It started in talent shows.
Yeah.
And then once we got a band together, then we started doing all the local clubs, you know, between Richmond and Petersburg and out in Tappahannock and places like that.
Right.
And finally, we ended up at the Landmark. Then it was the Moss. Mm-hmm. And we performed there after winning. We were second place? Third place.
Third place. Budweiser commercial.
Oh, wow. Did you cut the Budweiser commercial?
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. We had to do a 30-second version.
Somebody was supposed to bring that.
It was a 30-second version and a 60-second version. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think we were driving in the car when we heard our version of the 30-second commercial coming on, and it was like, it's like that age-old story. Oh, God, that's us. Hey, we won.
Yeah. Was that the first time you ever heard this thing play?
Yeah. And it was very interesting because they gave us an idea. You had to use the original tagline it. And Budweiser is the king of beers at that time.
You had to put that in the song somewhere.
Had to put that and do it all within 30 seconds. Right. So at that time, we had our own band, and we were already playing. So we just arranged and came up with it had our signature background vocals. And boom, that was it.
Yeah.
It was great.
I thought you you told me that you played in places like Ebony Island.
Yeah.
And places like that. Where else were you popular? And did you go outside of Richmond?
We did some stuff. Did we perform in New York once?
That was later.
That was much later.
Yeah, that's when we recorded Queen of My Universe.
Yeah.
And we in the studio in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it was Ebony Diamond or Ebony Diamonds first, right?
Yeah.
And then Essence?
Now, Essence was the very early.
Okay.
Because we were doing the a male gospel thing of boys in the dormitory at school.
Uh-huh.
And we were singing for like little in the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, was five of us at the time?
Yeah.
So you have five, and number five decide he wants to pledge a fraternity. And then all of a sudden, number four doesn't come to rehearsal when we've got to get these harmonies together. And then it becomes, he say, I can't come, but I got a friend of mine who wants to sing. I think we actually put up some flyers. We need a singer to fill in for this guy. And so number four brings his friend, and that happened to be Rodney Dorsey.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, he comes up like I said, wow, yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a couple of people we had to lose along the way.
Yeah.
And I kind of
like
became,
any band, right?
Yeah, you know, I kind of became the Otis Williams of the group. And,
yeah, that was him. So he's not here? He won't be.
he won't be here anymore.
Right. So the later stuff you said was more disco. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you record?
Yeah, we recorded a song called Party Man.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that was on White Horse Records on Doswell.
On the Doswell, yes. Yeah, you don't see a lot of Doswell records.
No, no, you don't.
You have to tell Dale about that.
And we released that and the flip side, I think it was called Put Everything in Place was the B-side.
Yeah.
And that got a little bit of airplay around the country. You know, mm-hmm. and locally.
Yeah.
You know, but again, the sales weren't there.
Right.
For that.
And I'm guessing that was pretty tough for independent artists
Because see, Richmond at that time was just booming with music, with bands and music. Yeah. I mean, you had Stand Room Only, Starfire, you had record company, what was Dynamic Entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Joe Carter.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had all those groups and they were, so you sort of had to find your niche,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so.
And also a lot of good music.
Though, oh, yeah. I still listen to that stuff because, you know, it's like it was produced really well. The bands were really good.
Mm-hmm.
Then by producing it like that, our thing as a group was not so much a good gigging band. We wanted to be that band that could have a good show, but we also made good records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we wanted to, because my thing was always about production and writing and stuff like
right,
that. So,
right. So you guys were you writing your own music? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At that point?
Yeah. Cause, Party Man was something that we wrote. I'm So Lucky was ours. And, you know, we had a band that was, we were all in college together.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all just influencing each other.
Right.
And we were just that, we were like a group of brothers, you know. They didn't mind playing behind us because we were doing some good stuff.
Right.
You know.
How big was the band?
At his Ziggis?
Yeah.
Seven? Eight?
Two guitars?
Yeah.
Keyboards? Drums? Horn?
Wow.
Never had horns.
We never had horns. We had two, we got to a point where we had two keyboard players.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was, and we had the female vocalist.
Yeah.
Yes.
What we used to do with the female vocalist as part of our show, it was interesting because the two guys, I would play keyboards. And so I became the second keyboard player. They became her backup vocalist. So it became another thing.
Yeah. She would do her set.
Yeah.
You know.
And we would be in the background behind her with the band.
Right.
You know.
So you were usually part of a package show. You'd have other groups.
Yeah, that didn't last long, I don't think.
We gigged a while with that combo with the opening show with the with the female vocalist, and then we came out, and the band actually did some numbers on their own.
Yeah, because you remember.
Did their own vocals.
At that time, we were doing like.
It was a whole show.
Yeah, we were doing 4-hour gigs at that time.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, which nobody does.
A combination of originals and covers.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig?
Oh, I'm just. Could you talk about the music scene at Virginia State? Because a lot of different bands came out of there while you guys were there.
That's you.
Okay. Music scene of Virginia State. Those talent shows that you talk about, every summer, the freshman group would come in to freshman orientation,
mm-hmm.
right? So the music department would produce the music for the freshman talent show. That was their thing. They'd been there all week. Friday was the friend. And it was like performing at the Apollo.
Yeah. Wow.
Because you had groups from Petersburg High School would come up to perform and groups from state. So, and individual singers and group. So we had the opportunity to perform, on that. And we performed a couple of our original songs and the audience was like quiet.
Mm.
And we go, oh God, we bombed.
Yeah.
No, we didn't bomb. They were actually listening.
Right. They were trying to figure out who is this.
Yeah. And what song is that?
Yeah.
You know, we never heard that on the radio, you know. And so we became, but we were still under that hierarchy because we were freshmen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had Trussell, mm-hmm. who was, you know, used to be the Snack Shop Band, and mm-hmm. They were the tops. Then we had another group who was called One Minute of Confusion. They were like the OJs. They had the gruff voices and the churchy gospel sound. And right. you could hear everybody that had a group, you could hear them singing on campus.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, was there a Richmond sound? Did people gravitate more toward a certain kind of soul, or was it funk, or what?
You know, I think it was a Richmond sound, and all the groups that we've already mentioned, mm-hmm. Starfire and Ujima and everybody that was around, Hold On Family, all those groups, Spectrum, they were out at the time, you know, and, you know, Philly had their sound, you know, and, you know, I guess Atlanta had theirs, Memphis had theirs, and I think there was collectively a Richmond sound.
Yeah, because another thing that happened too was that, in terms of the music industry and soul music at that time involving Richmond, there was that Richmond, Philly, New York, yeah. and which was the hub. I forgot D.C.
Yeah,
D.C. So you had people like Major Harris, who was from Richmond,
right.
ended up singing with the Delphonics, who were from Philly.
Yeah.
Okay, then you had another group who was, then you had somebody like Jonathan Williams, mm-hmm. who was a bass player, who was from Petersburg,
right.
who played with Nat Turner's Rebellion, who had Major Harris and Joe Jefferson, who wrote for the Spinners.
Right, a real seminal group.
Yeah. So then, with him being a bass player, he went on to play for the Moments, who were from New Jersey.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So that whole thing.
It's a very incestuous.
Oh, yeah. Everything, everybody sort of knew everybody, and, okay, you get your chance.
Yeah.
You know, and so, okay, yeah, we can do that.
Then that's when we kind of got the New Jersey connection.
Yeah.
And because George Kerr.
Yeah.
Produced
The Moments.
The Moments and a lot of groups
up there.
He's
the one who produced your Infinity stuff, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Well, talk about Bernard Smith, because he's always fascinated me. He didn't have a ton of stuff, but the stuff that he did was very, very distinctive. But
yeah.
Was he easy, hard to get along with? How'd you hook up with him?
He was a distant cousin of Rodney Dorsey.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they introduced us to him. We went by the house and met him and found out, first of all, he was a super talented guy.
Because
he could sing, he could write, he could produce, and he could play keyboards and bass and guitar.
Yeah.
You know, and he heard us sing and said, well, you know, maybe we can do something together. So I think that was his first release was For as long as I live.
Look, he brought us in the studio the same background. I think we did that in like one or two takes.
And was that also recorded at Alpha Audio?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and he also worked with Stan and Ramone.
Okay.
He produced Stan and Ramone.
He had his own band too, right? Bernard.
Yeah,
The Joker's Wild.
Yeah.
The Joker's Wild.
That was before he had come out of D.C. because he had worked with Van McCoy.
Right. The hustle guy.
Yeah. The hustle. Yeah. You know.
A big arranger.
Yeah.
Not just that song.
Yeah.
So I got to ask, Craig, are you going to be putting out any of this other music by these guys?
I would like to see that happen.
Yeah. What would stop it? I mean,
you have to
talk to these guys into it, right?
Yes, and maybe some other people and... You know, the stars have to line up again.
Right, right.
It's very possible.
Right.
Right, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I got some 16-track masters at
home. I should say that the new 45 has an exclusive on the B-side. We heard a little bit of it at the beginning of the segment, an instrumental version of it. So you guys are working off the master tapes.
Yeah.
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 We... Master set in my closet for 30 years.
Yeah.
And then Ray and I talked about it. I said, well, you know, we should go digitize them, right? Because the tapes have started to deteriorate.
Did you have to bake them?
Yeah.
Yeah. We took it up to Rockville, Maryland. I'm trying to pull up the name of the studio in Rockville.
Yeah.
But I'm not getting it yet.
It was one of the few that still had a machine that would do
the special.
Yeah, it was yeah. 2-inch tape, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah.
And it still could play 16
yeah.
track masters.
So yeah.
They could do it. And they digitized it on Pro Tools.
Right.
You know, and then we both had Pro Tools.
Yeah.
So we were able to drop it in and kind of remix it. And out of the collection, that's it. I'm so lucky it seems to be the one.
Right, right.
Yeah. And that's.
I think it's also important to note that they've continued to make music. I've heard some Ebony Diamond stuff that has a new jack swing.
Okay.
So they have continued to make music
together. So
you kept
going into the 90s?
And past,
yeah.
And past,
and past it.
Yeah, yeah. Past it.
21st century.
So there's a lot of stuff we can
consider. Well, I see a full-length album on Coliseum Records is how I sort of look at that.
Ooh.
That would be nice.
Do you have your other masters, or is that a special case?
We were never able to acquire the masters from the New Jersey, New York stuff, you know. The masters that we have are from Whitehorse Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were able to get those.
Would you guys, or do you guys still play live?
He does.
Okay.
Yeah, me. Because I got this, once the group stopped performing regularly, I just sort of kept writing and arranging and producing. Then I got into doing my own stuff. So I've done 3 solo albums. So, but the group is never far because it's like, you know, we've gotten together on occasions to, I call them up. I say, look, I got some songs that would be great for the group. Because they sound like the group.
Right.
So we will get together. So we got some stuff. I got some stuff in my studio that could be Ebony Diamond material.
Could record it at In Your Ear. Which,
yeah.
A lot of the old Alpha Audio guys are there now.
Oh, that's where they are.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Right.
Carlos and those guys.
Okay.
Carlos Chaitin.
Wow.
Anything that we haven't touched upon that you think people should know about this other than just go out there and get it?
Yeah.
It's just when you think it's all over, it may not be.
It may not be. That's true.
Well, we kind of started with that. Does it seem weird that you're talking about a song that's many, many decades old and people getting into it?
No, because it's like I said, what goes around is sort of like comes back around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after you get inundated by, you know, 24 hours of Beyonce and Jay-Z and, you know, not taking anything away from them, but, you know, a lot of us people need to know exactly where the music comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And the era that we came from was the original, what I call the original. Some people call it old school.
Yeah.
I call it my school because that's where I came from.
Yeah.
You know, the Philly sound. Everything had a sound. The Richmond sound, the Philly sound, the DC sound.
How would you characterize the Richmond sound? Was it sweet soul based?
It was all of that because you had these heavy funk bands like Poison and Trussell. And then you had the Waller family who were doing these sweet soul type things. And then you had the singing groups, which we came up in. And it just everybody took a little bit of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why. And you knew what to do. And it was live people playing live instruments.
Right, right.
You know.
The Waller family, that'd be a good one to reissue.
I think it has been.
Yeah, but not officially.
That was
bootleg,
unofficial?
Bootleg,
I didn't know that.
In fact,
was unofficial.
The band when I talked to him didn't even know that.
Oh.
Mm.
That deserves a
Japan.
Oh, that deserves a proper release, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. In any case, what's next for you, Craig?
What's next for Coliseum Records?
Yeah.
I wish I could tell you. I don't want to speak. No one has signed any papers yet, but we are looking at doing some things in the future. And I wish I could say more about them right now.
Yeah. Seems like we're in a different era with this stuff now with labels like Numeral Group and some of those labels that are sort of taking rediscovering songs mm-hmm. from the past. These songs are now being put on soundtracks to streaming shows and movies.
Commercials.
In fact, the Equatics from Hampton, a band that put a private press record out. I can't remember the show, but their song was featured on that. So it seems like anything is up for grabs now. You know?
Well, it still has to be good. It can't just be old. It's got to be good.
Yeah,
it's
got
to speak to people. And
but it doesn't have to be like a popular song. It can be a song that's made popular through the show.
Right, because good music is good music. And also you got to look at if you're producing a movie or a show, do you want to pay what Berry Gordy charges? Or do you want to pay, somebody local who needs a break?
Right, right. And maybe that song would have a different resonance because people
That's
don't
true.
Know it, you know.
Right.
And it's easier now with social media for talented people to get their music heard with TikTok and YouTube and, other sites like that. And then someone sees it, hears it, and says, hey, I need to give them a call.
Yeah.
So that's different than our era.
Yeah. Yeah. We had to, like I said, find your niche and be accepted.
Mm-hmm. You pay your dues.
Yeah. Oh, we paid them too. It was like,
Would you get hazed or would you get some other bands that would maybe play some pranks?
No.
Of it.
No, you just had to earn your spot.
Right.
They respected what you did, but you had, like Craig said, you had to be good.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking today with Ray Crawley and Carol Ellis Jr. of the group Ebony Diamonds and Craig Belcher of Coliseum Records. Ebony Diamonds' timeless 1975 soul song, I'm So Lucky, has now been reissued by Coliseum, and you can snag a copy on the group's Bandcamp page, right?
And our website, ColiseumRecords.com.
And where can people get the disc in stores? So they're in local stores?
It's at Plan I, and it's at Records and Relics.
I was going to say, I saw it there
the
other day. Yeah, he's pushing it.
Oh, good,
Craig
good,
is.
Good.
You heard a little bit of the instrumental track at the top of the segment, but we're going to take you out with a little taste of the vocal version of I'm So Lucky. Thank you, guys.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, great.
FM Richmond.
Radio for the rest of us.
See you.
Toss me a carrot. I'm gonna keep
keep well my vegetables cart.
The 7th annual Vegan Restaurant Challenge is coming up January 23rd and running through January 28th. Sponsored by the organization Vegan Action, this multi-venue event features area restaurants, cafes, bakeries, and food trucks upping their game on vegan food options in the form of special plant-based menu items not normally offered on their regular menus. This year, more than 30 different establishments, from 821 Cafe to Cobra Cabana to Ruby Scoops Ice Cream, will participate, with diners voting on their favorite plant-based entrees and desserts. I recently spoke with Vegan Action's Chrissy Vandenberg about this citywide foodie event, and yes, the conversation did make me hungry. Thanks for coming on the show this week.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Before we start talking about the event, tell me about the organization, Vegan Action. What do you do, and how long have you been around?
We have been around since 1995. So originally from Berkeley, California, and the organization moved to Richmond in 2000. And we have quite a lot of different programs. The main mission of Vegan Action is to encourage people to make choices to benefit the animals, the environment, and their health with vegan options. So generally food-focused, and then we, of course, kind of have these other programs as well. But in addition to being a national organization, we also work to have a really strong impact on our immediate community in Richmond. So we do a lot of tabling events, education events. We do cooking demos. And then we do this really cool V72 Vegan Food Week that I know you and I are going to talk about in a little bit.
Right, right. What's generally the thing that people get wrong about veganism and vegan food? Are there some off notions that you can dispel about?
Yeah, there definitely are. I think one of the most common ones is cost. A lot of folks think that it is more expensive to eat vegan.
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely just exclusively based on what you buy in the grocery store. So whether you're an omnivore, vegetarian, or vegan, there isn't any additional cost to being vegetarian or vegan. It's really just the products that you're buying. So essentially, whatever kind of food it is, if you're buying pre-made food, frozen food, specialty items, those are always more expensive. And so what I would often hear from folks is, oh my gosh, I could never afford to shop at Elwood Thompson's all the time. And
yeah.
I'm like, well, yeah, most of us can't. So shopping at the regular grocery store and buying just good whole grain, fresh foods is really actually very affordable. And I would argue even cheaper if you're making kind of good, thoughtful decisions about what you're buying in the grocery store.
Right.
And going out to eat, of course, is more expensive, again, whether you're omnivore, vegetarian, or vegan. But that kind of goes into the next point I wanted to make is accessibility. So I became vegan in 1995 in Richmond, and it was definitely challenging, especially to go out to eat. But there are so many options now, which has just made an incredible impact on accessibility for choosing vegan.
Yeah.
So that's definitely made things a lot easier. But, you know, we're all creatures of habit, and it's hard to make any kind of changes. I grew up eating meat, dairy, eggs, kind of the standard American diet, and slowly made some changes. And it definitely takes some more effort, learning how to cook a little bit differently, how to bake a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of a learning curve there. But yeah, I think one of the biggest things that holds folks back is really just habit. We just get used to cooking certain things, making certain things ordering certain things when we go out to eat. And so there is that purposefulness that is required to make that change. And a lot of people have indicated they want to eat more plant-based foods. Learning more that it is better for our health. It is definitely better for the environment to not support factory farming. And of course, it's definitely better for the animals to not raise them for food.
Yeah. Yeah. The notion that, you can just go out and find this food. I mean, a lot of the worst food is just the most available food.
Yes.
Junk food places all over the place. You don't necessarily have places serving vegan food.
Very true. I mean, like you said, the worst for our health food is the cheapest.
Mm-hmm.
And fast food places are a really good example. People can, you can get a regular cow burger for like $2.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Bucket of fried chicken for pretty cheap. And so between cost and that easy access of going through a drive-thru really quick, that is a hard thing to break, mm-hmm. hard thing to give up for mm-hmm. sure. So that's a difficult part of it. But one of the things I like to always mention to people is there are, unfortunately, government subsidies for animal products. So
mm-hmm.
for meat, dairy, and eggs, when people buy those, they're not the true cost.
Yeah.
So they're not the actual cost. And we as taxpayers are actually absorbing that cost. We're paying for that. So that could be, of course, another totally different conversation. But there is a reason these products are so cheap. But they're not benefiting us as far as our health, of course. They're not benefiting the animals. They're not benefiting the planet. But it is. It's hard for people to resist that quick and easy, cheap meal.
Right, right. Other times when there's no vegan restaurant challenge,
mm-hmm.
how do our area restaurants do as far as offering vegan options? Is it becoming a more prevalent or is it still maybe frustrating that there's not more?
It has gotten so much better. And I would say especially in the last 5 years, I think restaurants have definitely recognized there's the demand to have something more than just a black bean burger or a hummus appetizer.
Yeah.
And there's definitely been a concerted effort for restaurants and businesses in the Richmond area. And they're doing well. They're keeping these items on their menu and even adding more, which has been really, really amazing. Mm. The other thing I've really noticed in the last few years is restaurants making a note of what's vegetarian and vegan on their menus. So I'm seeing that more and more. It used to be pretty uncommon,
mm-hmm.
And definitely something that you would have to ask when you would go to that establishment.
Right.
But I've definitely noticed that more in the last few years, which has been great.
I'm looking at this list of the participating restaurants, and mm-hmm. it's all our favorite places. It's 821 Cafe, Cobra Cabana, Terrence, WPA Bakery, the Roosevelt. Maybe tell us the origin of the event. How many restaurants participated in the very first mm-hmm. vegan restaurant yeah. challenge?
Yeah, so 7 years ago when we were sitting around having a meeting and thought, what's something fun and exciting we could do to get restaurants a little bit more involved and maybe a little bit more excited about having a vegan option that they don't normally make. So we approached it as a challenge. So asking restaurants, would you challenge your chefs to make something really awesome and exciting and just see how it goes? And the idea, of course, was to have their chefs have the opportunity to be creative mm-hmm. and kind of having, like, you know, open-ended, whatever they want to do, as long as it's vegan. Potentially getting vegans to their restaurant that had possibly never been there before. And then also their regular customers maybe would be willing to try a vegan option if they aren't normally choosing one.
Right.
So we reached out and we ended up having 22 establishments that first year.
Wow.
And it was really exciting. We just had no idea what to expect. We know that this is extra work on their end. We did choose the month of January. It is generally the slowest month of the year for restaurants, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, post-holiday. So we thought that that would be really helpful. And, you know, we all need something fun to look forward to.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, this is a good way to get the vegans out and patronizing the restaurants.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that was really fun. And also that first year we had an event. There is this cookbook author on the West Coast in California called the Black Metal Chef.
Mm-hmm.
And we had him come out and do a live demo at Strange Matter, which was really cool. That sold out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a guitar playing competition to win a free guitar at that same event. And we had a couple speakers come from out of town. So we actually had an in-person event in addition to the restaurant challenge. So that was really cool. We did that for a couple of years and then of course COVID. So then we just went to restaurant only, but we are planning on in 2025, bringing back the in-person event of having cooking demos, speakers, and kind of, you know, some more fun in-person event again, because that was just such an exciting addition to going out and eating at restaurants.
Right, right. Okay, let's get into the real nitty-gritty here. What are some of the kinds of dishes that are served or that have been served in the past? Maybe you don't exactly know what people will serve, what restaurants will serve this time. But what are some of the kinds of dishes that people can expect?
Yeah. So we have quite a few, pizza places participating this year.
Mm.
And so they always are coming up with something fun, especially the Hop Craft and Brewery.
Yeah.
They won a few years ago with a pizza called the Pickleback, and it was such a hit that they have that on their permanent menu. But the Hop always comes up with something really fun, creative, and unusual for their pizzas, which is always fun. So I always make sure to go by there. Who else? Oh, Max is on Broad, who sadly closed recently, but they participated the last 2 years, and their chefs reported that they loved this challenge. They don't have a standard vegan option on their menu. Well, they didn't. But they last year they did an oyster mushroom scallop pasta that was incredible. They did actually win an award for that. A21 always does something really fun with a really fun name. Last year they did something called His Hero Is Gone, which was a hero sandwich. They really get into it too. Chip and Andrew love it. There's a newer restaurant called Devil's Lettuce. I'm not sure if you've heard of them.
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. Short Pump. They are really fun. They really get into it, and they have a really fun crunch wrap they're making for this year's dish. So the dishes are slowly coming in from the restaurants that'll be part of the challenge this year.
Now,
so
do they have to run these by you? Do they have to, like, is this vegan enough? Or is there any sort of process that they have to go through?
Right. They do. Yeah. So they do have to submit them for us to review, and just sometimes we'll have some questions just to confirm, you know, making sure that the bread if you would double check, make sure the bread doesn't have any animal ingredients, things like that. So there's sometimes is a little bit back and forth. So we do approve the dishes and then get final description and photos from the businesses that we can then share online, because that's, of course, what gets everybody really excited.
Yeah, I'd like to submit myself as a judge for next year's. So you also have dessert place. You have Ruby Scoops ice cream, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And is it Idle Hands Bakeries there, too? And
you know, Idle Hands, it is, I know, a challenging time of year for Jay. So Idle Hands has participated some years in the past.
Right.
But unfortunately, isn't this year. They have made some incredible, Jay's made some incredible specials in the past. And one of his, 1 year, I think it was 2 years ago, he made a, think about it. I'm going to remember what it was called. Oh, a cannoli cruffin.
I saw that. Yes.
And that was just incredible. He did win an award for that. So at the end of the event, we put out a patron survey. So everybody that had a chance to get out and try at least one V72 dish, we have them vote on their favorite savory and their favorite sweet, which is also really fun.
Yeah. I meant to say WPA Bakery. They're part of it, right?
Yes. Yeah, they are. They are again this year. I could give you a sneak report of what they're making this time. It sounds amazing. They're going to do a vegan biscuits and sausage gravy.
Mm.
And then a special vegan breakfast sandwich and tag-along pie, which is one of my favorites in the whole world, which is peanut butter with chocolate ganache.
Wow. So are there different categories? Now this is a contest, right?
This is a contest. Yep, absolutely.
And I guess there's a savory prize and a dessert prize, right?
Right. Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned before we began that there are some changes this year. There's some exciting new changes to the whole process.
Yes. So we got a little bit stricter with this. We in the past have had up to 37 businesses participate. So we have gotten a little stricter about accepting dishes and making sure that they're submitted in advance and approved. Mm-hmm. And we get kind of all the detailed information. We talked about the people voting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the winners, they get a plaque, but they also sign off on a passport for folks that go around to the different restaurants, and they can go get a free treat from Ruby Scoops. You'd mentioned Ruby Scoops earlier.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha.
So that's another exciting part that we're going to have printed out passports this year so that and will be available at the establishments. So folks can pick those up when they go and visit and collect their signatures from each restaurant so that they can go to Ruby Scoops and get their free sweet treat.
Nice. So how do you see the event changing from here on out? Do you see it getting bigger, more days, more restaurants? What do you see for the future of this?
Originally, it did start out as 3 days. But then we heard back from patrons and from restaurants and folks that are participating and saying, you know, I think we should do this longer. So we said, absolutely, let's open it up to be more days. So now we do it Tuesday through Sunday. So that's a change we made 2 years ago. And as long as we have restaurants submitting exciting, unique dishes that they don't keep on their regular, that aren't on their regular menu. So we want that incentive for folks to go to that restaurant. They can't go in December and get it. They can't go in March and get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so special and unique. So as long as restaurants have those specific guidelines and, then yeah, we could absolutely expand to more.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that often the restaurants will continue to offer their special features.
Yes, yes, which of course we love that. We love that they add those to their actual menu. Then that means they have to come up with something new and exciting for the next year.
Right, right.
Which they have done for sure. All of the, we definitely have quite a few. I would say 10 to 12 businesses that have participated every single time the last 7 years, yeah. Which has been really exciting. And we also have partnered with Ninja Kombucha again this year. We did last year.
Mm-hmm.
They made a special B72 carrot ginger kombucha, and it was a huge hit. So they're going to remake that again for everyone this year, which is really great. They will be distributing this special flavor in a few businesses around town, but of course they have a brick and mortar on Brooklyn Parkway.
Yeah. Brooklyn Park Boulevard, yeah.
Brooklyn Park, yeah. So they've been really fun to partner with the last few years. But we really are looking forward to having the in-person event again starting next year.
Right.
Which I think will be really great, great added bonus.
With the cooking demonstrations and so forth?
Exactly, yes. One other really exciting thing we're doing this year is we've partnered with Matchbox Mutual Aid. They are a not-for-profit umbrella organization for RVA community free fridges and food not bombs.
Mm-hmm.
So the restaurants that will be participating in B72 will be making donations to Matchbox Mutual Aid from the sales of their B72 dishes this year.
We're out of time, but what else has Vegan Action got going on? Anything, any other events or special things that people should know about coming up?
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a slow time of year, but we do have some tabling events and cooking demos coming up in June, which does feel kind of far away.
Mm-hmm.
But for now, we're just really focused on this and then planning all of our events for the rest of the year.
Gotcha. Well, you're listening to Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison. And I've been speaking with Chrissy Vandenberg, the Executive Director of Vegan Action, all about the nonprofit organization's 7th Annual Vegan Restaurant Challenge. It's going to happen January 23rd to the 28th in restaurants, cafes, bakeries, and food trucks across Richmond. Where can people go to get more information?
Ah, thanks for asking. We have a special website just for this event. It's vegan72.com. And then we have our regular all-around website, vegan.org. So information on both of those.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming on, and I can't wait to try some of these dishes out.
Thanks, Don. I'm so excited, too.
Dog bites. If you've ever been bitten by a dog, it's a terrifying feeling. Now imagine that happening inside of a prison. Last summer, Business Insider Hannah Beckler published an in-depth report about canine attacks inside of correctional facilities showing that around 90% of canine attacks occurring in prisons between 2017 and 2022 were in Virginia, with 271 dog bites. Used to break up fights or get inmates out of their cells. Most states have already eliminated this arcane practice, but it remains in Virginia. There's an attempt to change that. Inspired after reading the report, Delegate Holly Siebold, a Democrat, proposed a bill that would end correctional facilities using canines from attacking inmates inside Virginia's correctional facilities. Exceptions would be made to canine units that were working as search dogs or as dogs to help with PTSD and other healing after traumatic events.
There's no proof that actually shows that having canines in prisons helps keep inmates and corrections officers safe. In fact, quite the opposite.
Siebold says she has reached out to families with loved ones in prisons.
And I actually ask those families who are very concerned about their loved ones. They're very concerned. They're very concerned, particularly about the violence in the prisons. And I said, you know, I have carrying a bill that's going to ban canines from prisons. Am I making you, like, am I increasing your concerns? Am I increasing your anxiety by pulling these dogs out? Do you feel safer with the dogs in the prisons? Do you feel like it keeps the violence down, which is really what DOC claims? It was an absolute no. Absolutely. No question that these dogs increase violence. In fact, the dogs themselves are very violent.
Virginia Department of Corrections still practices the use of canines in Virginia correctional facilities. Delegate Michael Webert, a Republican, has proposed a solution that would compromise, limiting when correction officers can use these canines. Webert pointed out that it is effective to use them as a less lethal use of force. He also pointed out that the Department of Corrections does not currently have the same requirements to have standards like other law enforcement departments.
And part of the reason is, just like in law, regular law enforcement, the use of a dog can be an intermediary before use of lethal force is absolutely necessary. And so the dog is a tool that can be used for the protection of both prisoners and the prison guards. And so we felt that it was necessary to work within the parameters. And then also one of the things that we learned is that there was no real set of standards for the use of those dogs, whereas almost every other area of law enforcement has best practices and competitions, et cetera, with the use of them. And so we wanted to, establish that as well so that they're used in the best practices possible.
One thing that both of these delegates can agree on is that the current use of attack dogs does not make prisons any safer for the inmates or for the officers, as well as inhumane for these dogs. As the legislative session kicks off, both Democrats and Republicans will work on something that can get a signature from the governor and address this issue. Limiting the attacks of canines and requiring more training on canines could make them no longer cost-effective and could phase them out over time.
These are maximum security prisons. So it's kind of an the unexpected situation. We want to make sure Corrections has the tools they need. Just, I think, with the numbers that came out, it was clear that there's probably some times they're being used where they're not needed.
For Open Source RVA, this is Goad Gatsby reporting from the Virginia Capitol in Richmond. Be sure to follow my work, at Goad Gatsby on Twitter, RVA Mag, and tune into Richmond Cryptoids on Monday nights at 11 p.m. on 97.3 FM. WRIR.
And that's all she wrote for Open Source RVA. Thanks for listening to Richmond's Audio News Digest. Don Harrison is the host, and the show's producer is Christy Albus. Goad Gatsby is the source roving correspondent, and I'm the engineer and production assistant, Chuck Moore. The show's co-host, Dina Weinstein, was off this week. Dina's been abroad studying the vibrant culture and distinctive cuisine of Paris, France. Mike McKenzie was also off this week. Mike's been on Hull Street trying to score a bulk quantity of just expired pork cracklings from Lonnie's, proprietor of Yum Yum Truck, which sets up right next to the dumpsters behind the big lots. Hey, like Open Source RVA on Facebook, why don't you? And listen to past episodes on our program on our SoundCloud page. And join us next week, same bat time, same bat channel, for another thrill-packed installment of Open Source RVA.